The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Georgine Rice Show. James Blind is producing, Clark Hilton engineering, and Dan Rice. He's given up the use of his office slash music room for the sake of the cause, so I really appreciate that. Today, we're going to take a look at the bumpiest vaccine rollout yet, and some of Dr. Fauci's mixed messages on masks and vaccines and reopenings. In the next hour of the program, we're going to talk about some of the things you need to know about the COVID-19 package. It may be exciting to think about getting another check, but how much of that package actually has anything to do with COVID-19? We'll look at that and much, much more today on The Georgine Rice Show. Well, as mentioned, the bumpiest rollout yet. That's how they're describing the Portland effort to expand the number of area seniors who have run into problems trying to sign up for, emphasize trying to sign up for the COVID-19 vaccine appointments that were available yesterday and will be for those who have reached age 70 and up. Well, many Portland area seniors and older folks here in the community encountered very slow moving websites. Majority of glitches on Monday continued as they tried to just, well, unsuccessfully schedule COVID-19 vaccination appointments at one of the area's two mass vaccination sites. Well, some elderly residents reported that it took anywhere from a few minutes to more than a half hour to schedule pages to load. And then when they got to the pages and clicked on available appointment times, they were told appointments were already taken. That meant they would have to begin the time-consuming process of reloading pages and starting the booking process again. All available online appointments for the Oregon Convention Center and the Portland International Airport's drive-through clinic were taken well within the first hour. Well, that, of course, was frustrating to seniors who, in some instances, took complaints straight to state lawmakers. One, a spokeswoman for the vaccination site, acknowledged that various challenges on Monday, including the mistake that allowed people to book appointments early and left others empty-handed. The appointment scheduling tool didn't crash this morning. However, they did slow down as they approached maximum capacity, which is 4,800 concurrent users each. She said in an email on Monday afternoon that, well, that's how this is rolling out. Some technicians have fixed either in place or underway to improve the site stability and user experience moving forward to, well, on days appointments are open for booking in the future. And there is apparently a future for those who were unable to book appointments but still want them moving forward. Bumpiest rollout yet. Patience is in order. We certainly have been in a season in which patience has been kind of the hallmark of what's necessary for virtually everything. So maybe we could get a little practice in through that effort as well. Meanwhile, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the director, Anthony Fauci, he often inconsistently offered comments and mixed messages on the coronavirus pandemic, and that's prompting some renewed scrutiny as the debate rages over reopening schools and businesses nearly a year after the lockdown started. A year. Well, Dr. Fauci is a very good public health official. His job is to advise public policymakers, rather, and inform the public. That's what Senator Marco Rubio from Florida said on Tuesday. But his job is not to decide what we can do, where we can go, or which places can open or close. His job is not to mislead or scare us into, well, doing the right things. Well, why should we trust Fauci with the national plan? Back in March, he famously told Americans there's no reason to be walking around with a mask. Dr. David Harsanyi of the National Review reminds us. Well, Fauci is in an interview with 60 Minutes in early March of last year, warned of unintended consequences of masks, saying people keep fiddling with the masks and they keep touching their faces. On masks, Dr. Fauci and former Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who also warned against buying and wearing masks in the spring of 2020, if you can think back that far, said officials recommended against wearing masks early in the pandemic because at the time there was a massive shortage of PPE for medical workers who needed to have them the most. Further, more evidence of asymptomatic spread of the virus later came out. Fauci later enthusiastically embraced wearing masks. What has changed in our recommendations? Well, Adams said in a White House briefing in July, we now know from recent studies that a significant portion of individuals with coronavirus lack symptoms. So we were told that that's why we should reconsider. Now, Fauci, more recently has backed recommendations that Americans wear two masks instead of one, if possible, in order to keep the mask tighter on people's faces. If you have a physical covering with one layer, you put another layer on top of that, it makes common sense that it likely will be more effective, he told NBC News last month. The CDC officially put out double masking guidelines this month. So things have changed. And then there are vaccinations. Another issue on which Fauci has adjusted his stance is on exactly, well, what level of vaccination is necessary for the American people to reach herd immunity to the virus. Now, Fauci previously said the percentage of people who need to be vaccinated to reach that goal of 70% before revising that number up to a higher number is 80%. So this inspired a story in the New York Times that accused Fauci of quietly shifting recommendations. Well, Fauci then explained to the paper that he was taking public opinion polls into account in how he shaped his comments. What polls said, only about half of all Americans would take the vaccine. I was saying herd immunity would take 70 to 75%. Well, Fauci, according to the paper, then said that when newer surveys said 60% or more would take it, I thought I can nudge this up a bit. So I went to 80 and 85. He went on to say, we have to have some humility here. We really don't know what the real number is. I think the real range is somewhere between 70 to 90%, but I'm not going to say 90%. Now, this is Fauci, whose views on various aspects of this pandemic have changed rather dramatically. On returning to normal after Americans get their vaccines, Fauci has made several different comments that are not necessarily consistent. He says it's going to depend very much on what the percentage or level of efficacy to the vaccine is. He said in an interview of what post-vaccine life would look like with Bloomberg in August, I would be very happy if 70 to 75% and would be accepting 50 to 60%. Well, now he has said we're probably going to end up wearing masks into the year 2022. Now, with a majority of the people, this is presumably vaccinated, why two masks into all of 2022? Not entirely clear. More than 500,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus, which is an airborne disease. It's not severe in most healthy people, but can be deadly to older people and those with compromised immune systems. Those who are more critical of Fauci say he made pronouncements of science with far too much finality, when the science was not, in fact, settled. And has not leveled with the American people in some cases, including on the length of the lockdowns. Also this month, Fauci on NBC News Today said that by the time we get to April, that would be what I would call open season on vaccines, and nearly a full vaccination by the middle of or end of next summer. The epidemiologist was then contradicted by President Biden, who said in a CNN town hall, the vaccine would be available to all Americans by the end of July, and it would take longer then to get doses to everyone in their arms. Well, Fox News reached out to the NIAID for comment of Fauci's messaging on masks and herd immunity and vaccines and when people can return to normal, and didn't receive a response. Then finally, there are lockdowns. We'll take a look at that in just a moment because, of course, we are, for the most part, on some kind of lockdown. So we'll take a look at it in a moment. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show. We've been looking at Dr. Fauci and some of the messages he's been giving on masks and vaccines and reopenings and much more. We're also going to hear from John Barry, author of Jesus Economy, A Biblical View of Poverty and the Currency of Love and a Pattern for Lasting Change. That's coming up. I also want to remind you that tomorrow, maybe just tell you for the first time, that we are going to join with our partners, India Partners, for a radiothon you do not want to miss. We're going to try to generate some support to provide ways to build water wells for those who desperately need them. And it really translates into the life-giving water that people need, both physically and spiritually. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But we're looking at Dr. Fauci and how he is informed, if you will, the American people on a variety of subjects, including lockdowns. Well, lots of us continue to wonder when the nation's top infectious disease expert will tell us when you can resume life as normal. Now, one issue on which Dr. Fauci has remained more consistent is the reopening of schools, which he's reiterated is possible before teachers get vaccinated. Well, in fact, he said this month on CBS, rather, that vaccinating every teacher before opening schools is non-workable. Well, he said on Sunday, declining to say on CNN, that grandparents who are fully vaccinated could see their grandchildren saying, "I don't want to be making a recommendation now on public TV. I would want to sit down with a team to take a look." So what does that mean for seniors who are vaccinated? Well, he went on to say that prompted a rant from Meghan McCain on The View. "I was very frustrated when I saw this clip," she says. "The fact that Dr. Fauci is going on CNN and he can't tell me if I get a vaccine, I'll be able to have dinner with my family is terribly inconsistent message, and it continues to be inconsistent." Well, Fauci answered some of that criticism on CNN Tuesday, saying, "If I'm fully vaccinated and my daughter comes in my house and she's fully vaccinated, common sense tells you that, in fact, you don't have to be as stringent." But he added, "We want to get firm recommendations from the CDC on what people can and cannot do before and when they are vaccinated." So again, it's very frustrating. There's a difficulty getting concrete answers as to what we can expect with a vaccine, without one, and so on. Anyway, we'll continue to follow that sadly developing story. Well, in other news, a State Department briefing got heated as a reporter asked if President Biden's administration is taking credit for Trump accomplishments. Well, as an Associated Press reporter took the State Department spokesman Ned Price to task on Monday for suggesting that President Joe Biden was responsible for a policy that had started under the Trump administration. Well, Price highlighted a report sent to Congress, said some 18 entities have engaged in good faith efforts to scale back their involvement in Nord Stream 2, a controversial $11 billion pipeline project designed to transmit Russian natural gas to Germany. So critics of the Kremlin have said the project would double the amount of natural gas imported from Russia. If completed, it would leave Europe more dependent on Russian energy than ever before. Now, the poisoning of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny has revitalized calls for the project to be abandoned. And in Monday's press conference, Price seemed to suggest that the Biden administration's efforts had led to the development on Nord Stream 2. The aforementioned entities had wound down their activities in the pipeline project, and Price said and demonstrated that Biden and Congress strategy has been working to good effect, end quote. Well, Associated Press reporter Matt Lee piped in, telling Price that all of this work had begun under the Trump administration. "You guys have only been in office for a month, right? Are you telling me that in the last 4 weeks, these 18 companies all of a sudden decided to say, we better not do anything with Nord Stream 2? You guys are taking credit for stuff the previous administration did, yes or no?" Well, Secretary Price, noticeably flustered, said that he was merely speaking on behalf of the State Department, occupied by the same people since Biden took office. Well, the heated exchange came after the Biden administration on Friday added a layer of sanctions to a Russian vessel and the ship owner for their work on the pipeline project. Well, in other developments, Jason Chaffetz, said that Biden-Harris' disastrous start, first month full of hypocrisy, scandal, and incompetence. Well, Trump says that the Supreme Court tax return decision is a continuation of the greatest political witch hunt. And he's going to speak at CPAC, the conference, and it will be his first public appearance post-White House. Michael Goodwin, Biden says that Biden receives Obama policies and each one hurts Americans. He's reviving those old projects and people are paying the price. Three questions the AG nominee Merrick Garland dodged from the Senate Republicans in his nomination hearing. Judge Merrick Garland, President Biden's attorney general nominee, reportedly avoided providing direct answers to questions from Republican senators during Monday's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Garland dodged questions about the Durham investigation into the Trump-Russia probe origins, transgender athletes in high school sports, and whether crossing the border illegally should be a criminal offense. Senator Josh Hawley asked Garland whether he believes that illegally crossing the border should remain a crime. Well, Garland said, "I haven't thought about that question. I just haven't thought about that question," end quote. Well, the president has made clear that we are a nation with borders, with national security. I don't know of a proposal to decriminalize, but still make it unlawful to answer. I just haven't thought about it, which is rather peculiar given the fact that he is being scrutinized to become the next leader in this area, dodging questions in the hearing that will determine whether or not he will move forward. Garland similarly declined to make a firm committal to leaving Special Counsel John Durham in place to continue his investigation into the origins of the Trump-Russia probe. Garland said he has no reason to think that leaving Durham in place to continue his investigation was the wrong decision, but he declined to actually make an answer to that question. Again, rather peculiar. He's not committing to a course of action. In other news, the Senate voted 78-20 to confirm Linda Thomas Greenfield as Ambassador of the United Nations on Tuesday. Thomas Greenfield is a veteran diplomat who rose through the Foreign Service and served as head of the African Affairs in the State Department from 2013 through 2017. During her service, she oversaw the U.S. response to the Ebola epidemic. Republicans have expressed skepticism over her October 2019 speech on the relationship between China and the African continent. The speech was delivered at a Confucius Institute at Savannah State University, and the Trump administration later designated the network of institutes as a foreign mission. This nominee has spent years minimizing the threat of China's actions in Africa and has spoken repeatedly in favor of China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is a transparent ploy to spread Chinese communist influence into other countries. That was a quote from Senator Tom Cotton in a statement. Well, Cotton was one of the 20 senators to oppose Thomas Greenfield's confirmation. During her hearing, the speech was a huge mistake. I do regret that speech, Thomas Greenfield said back in January. But if you look at what I have done prior to that, there's no question that I am not at all naive about what the Chinese are doing. And I have called them out on a regular bias, including today. Well, his pick following that speech was, in fact, confirmed as the UN ambassador, despite her ties to China.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
I have so looked forward to the conversation I'm about to have with my next guest, Mary Graybar. She's the author of Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America. Well, Marxist talking points are dominating American education, brainwashing students to believe American history is nothing more than a litany of oppression, slavery, and exploitation. As an African American, I understand our history. I know it. My family was impacted by it. But I don't buy this stuff. How has this happened? Since 1980, socialist Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States has dominated the American education system as the textbook of choice for leftist teachers across the country, turning young students against America and into foot soldiers for a progressive revolution. If you want to know where much of what we're seeing now has come from, well, in the book Debunking Howard Zinn, exposing the fake history that turned a generation against America, my guest demolishes his popular history, a history pushed by Hollywood celebrities, defended by university professors who know better, and assigned in high school and college classrooms. There's even a children's version. She reveals Zinn's bag of dishonest rhetorical tricks, his slavish reliance on partisan history, explicit rejection of historical balance, a selective quotation of sources to convey the exact opposite message of what their author intended. Well, Mary Graybar is a resident fellow at the Alexander Hamilton Institute for the Study of Western Civilization and the founder of the Dissident Professor Prof Education Project. She taught at the college level for 20 years, most recently at Emory University, and her work has been published by The Federalist, Town Hall, Front Page Magazine, City Journal, and many, many others. She joins us today to debunk Howard Zinn. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. I want to begin by just asking, who is Howard Zinn? Because while in academic circles, he's well known, in education circles, where his book is pushed and a children's version is now widely available, most people may have, the book came out in what, 1980? Most people have no idea who Howard Zinn is, although they have seen his influence.
Yeah, well, Howard Zinn died in 2010. He was born in 1922. He was a member of the Communist Party, actually. We're 99% certain of that. But he promoted a communist message in his book and in his other writings and spoke favorably about communism. He taught at Spelman College from 1956 to 1963, which then really did adhere to its Christian principles. And then was fired from there, incidentally, by the first black president of the college and the first male president of the college for insubordination. He led the students on these protests that were harmful to them and inspired them to rebel against the administration and against going to chapel and so forth. But he was soon landed on his feet, and he was at Boston University, where he taught until he retired in 1988. And he was asked to write A People's History of the United States in the late 1970s. And basically, as you reviewed, he wildly distorted the history, threw together, dubious sources and cobbled together this book, which has exceeded all records for a history book of its type in terms of sales and influence.
It really is quite remarkable how that has happened. You write in the, I think it's in the preface of the book, about the context in which this book emerged. There were a number of historians who were discredited at that time as his book was about to come out, and somehow his emerged and flourished when a number of historians were discredited, even though he's not a great historian, and even critics who would agree with some of his priorities had to say that this is not a good work of history.
Oh, absolutely. There's Michael Kazin, well-known leftist, and when he reviewed the book, he called it more appropriate to a conspiracy monger's website than to a history book. So it was criticized on the left as well. I mean, by any standard measure of history writing, what's in A People's History is fraudulent. It's, it's not backed up by statistics. It, promotes rumors, a conspiracy theory. He takes quotations out of context. He makes speakers say the opposite of what they really did say. And up until now, no one has really gone through his book and systematically checked it against his sources or what other historians have said. And I did check with historians both on the right and on the left. And I went through his own papers at New York University. I went to the Martin Luther King Center. I went to the Library of Congress and Emory University and did research and discovered that this book is a fraudulent piece of history.
And yet,
deliberately so.
And yet, it's a very popular book, and in the academy, it's embraced in colleges and universities all across the country. The young people who were raised on this book are now lawmakers. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one example, running on socialist platforms. How did his teachings influence this?
Well, you know, when you hear something like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calling the detention centers, you know, of the people who are trying to come into the country concentration camps, that's exactly what Howard Zinn did in the People's History. So, you know, we interned the Japanese Americans during World War II. That was widely known, you know, even before the order was given. And that's been criticized. And it was criticized, actually, by J. Edgar Hoover and George Schuyler, a prominent African-American journalist at the time, a conservative, also by Senator Robert Taft. So there is a debate about, you know, whether or not that should have been done within the context mm-hmm. of war and what the fears were. But by no stretch of the imagination could those be called concentration camps. And, you know, Howard Zinn lied about the information. I mentioned that Kazin called his book, you know, a conspiracy theory. Well, Howard Zinn presents his evidence is that there was an article in late 1945 at the end of the war that exposed these so-called concentration camps. Well, that's patently false. There were daily newspaper articles about, you know, sort of the police going after the Japanese as well as German Americans and Italian Americans, you know, who were suspect. There are daily reports. There was a film narrated by Milton Eisenhower shown in movie theaters. There was actually an article in the 1942 Harper's Magazine, the same magazine that he cites, that describes life in these camps. You know, it wasn't luxurious, but they were clean. The food was good. There was plenty of it. There was a Foreign Legion station in the one he went to. People had gardens. Their children played baseball. So it's obscene to claim that those camps were concentration camps. And as people have rightfully said about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's statement, you know, and one of the things I point out also is this has such an influence on millennials, you know, the majority of whom now approve of socialism or communism over capitalism. There is a woman who was elected to the Oklahoma City Council, and instead of placing her hand on a Bible, she placed it on a People's History of the United States.
Written by Howard Zinn. Now, how did his history become so popular? You, in the introduction, remind us that in Good Will Hunting, there is a reference, several references made there, and that Hollywood has helped to popularize all of this. But trace for us how his history became so popular.
Well, the ground had been set. So a lot of the people, you know, the 1960s generation, the Vietnam protesters, they went into education. There have been studies done of the percentage of them, and it's disproportionately high. And so they were already writing these ideological left-wing histories. A prominent historian, Oscar Handlin, had, you know, criticized them. Other historians had criticized them. Well, Howard then took what they wrote and just ran with it. He made it, you know, even worse. He magnified what they were saying, and he put it together in this book. But he also added this flair. He had this ability to write and to touch people's emotions. He did it illegitimately, but he was able to do that. So he has made people cry, you know, after they read a people's history. Some have become angered. He's inspired Antifa, the guy that was going to blow up, you know, the detention center in Tacoma, if you recall that, maybe about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
He, in his manifesto, said, read Howard Zinn. He was his hero.
Yeah. We're going to continue our conversation, but I do need to take a quick break. Again, we are talking with Mary Graybar. She's the author of Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America, a very important book to deconstruct what he has, his influence, what he has written, and what the truth is. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States has sold more than 2.5 million copies. It's pushed by Hollywood celebrities, defended by university professors who should know better, assigned in high school and college classrooms to teach students that American history is nothing more than a litany of oppression, slavery, and exploitation. His history is popular, but it's also massively wrong. Joining us to talk about that and continuing our conversation is scholar Mary Graybar, who is the author of Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America. Well, there certainly are influencers who have pushed this book and popularized it. But what significance role has Zinn played in today's education system, his book as well as his system of education?
Teachers have adopted his own teaching strategies, which involve not, you know, extensive reading and writing papers and doing research, but going out and protesting and keeping journal entries and, not taking any tests. So there has been the destruction of knowledge. But his book is being used, The People's History of the United States, is being used in colleges of education. And sometimes the teachers that, you know, are using that book are not getting any other version of American history. So that's what they get, and they pass it on down to their students. And as you probably know, most of the textbooks that are adopted are left-wing anyways. And so they have this notion that Howard Zinn's version of history is true. And so they pass that on to their students. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, people who read A People's History when it came out in the 80s, they've had children, they may have grandchildren by now, and so they think that his version of history is the real one. They don't think there is anything wrong with it. That is passed on through the generations, and so we're getting into the second generation of Zinn's influence. Teachers also can go to the Zinn Education Project and download lessons from the book. Right now, there is a campaign to abolish Columbus Day. The Smithsonian, I wrote about this yesterday, is sponsoring teach-ins for teachers and using Zinn's materials. And they are learning how to lobby legislators to abolish Columbus Day. There are graphic books, you know, comic books, with Howard Zinn. He appears in song lyrics. There's a play, it's going to be on Broadway about his life. They have book festivals dedicated to him. Occupy Wall Street had a library in New York City, and Howard Zinn's books were staples. Black Lives Matter, they're influenced by Zinn, and now Antifa is influenced by Zinn. And I think we're really getting into some dangerous territory when we're talking about Antifa. So it's difficult to measure, but if you ask any, you know, the common person, they'll likely say, yeah, I've heard of Zinn. Some people, saw Good Will Hunting and were introduced to him. Mm-hmm. Teachers, professors are introducing students to him, recommending him. I just heard of that a couple weeks ago. So it's not measured, but by the book sales, by the adoption in the classroom, by the cultural references, Zen's influence, we know, is just growing exponentially.
I think most people assume that once something is in print, if it's embraced by the academy, that there must be good scholarship. Yet even those on either side of the ideological spectrum have acknowledged that Zen's scholarship is poorly done. And it's hard to imagine how he has succeeded as well as he has, particularly among academics. Is it because he is parroting what they want to hear? How is it that he has managed to resonate with so many, despite the fact that his scholarship is so poor?
I think you pinpointed a large part of that, and this is something that I go into in my book.
Yes.
Michael Kazin, the scholar I mentioned, you know, on the left, you know, was once a member of the Weather Underground and criticized Zen when the book came out. But in 2010, Mitch Daniels, when he was governor of Indiana, had emailed people in education. He learned that Zen's book was being used in an NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, summer session for teachers to get continuing education. And he was outraged and expressed it in these emails. Well, these were revealed by an AP reporter in 2013. And by that time, Mitch Daniels was president of Purdue. And Michael Kazin and the other leftists who had criticized Zen now attacked Mitch Daniels. I mean, it's truly amazing, you know, how they went 180 degrees and, you know, accused Mitch Daniels of ignorance and censorship and not understanding how history is written. Hmm. To attack Zen is sacrilegious in leftist academia. I got a couple pieces of hate mail before the book was out.
You know? Yeah, because you don't challenge the oracle of Zen. It's important for us to understand his influence, to understand his writing. What do you hope to accomplish when people have a better appreciation for how he has managed to work his way into our education system to influence generations? And are you hopeful that we can reverse course with a clear, accurate understanding of history?
Yes. Well, my book is intended to be a tool, an expose. Up to now, I don't think that students who were fed this stuff or parents or the general public had something that would rebut what Howard Zinn is saying. So I try to lay it out. And so every time he makes a misstatement or he plagiarizes or he quotes out of context or just lies, I come back and with other sources, with my original research, and expose that. So for students who may be facing a professor, you know, who loves Howard Zinn and his spouting his view of history, they can have this book and go back and say, well, okay, this is what Howard Zinn says, and this is actually what the truth is. And they can go back and check all my footnotes. This is extensively footnoted. And they can have a tool, and maybe this will help us to bring down Zinn's reputation, and to expose his fraudulence as a scholar. He is not a legitimate historian or a scholar. He is a communist propagandist.
I am so grateful for the book. I am grateful for the time that you've spent talking with us about it today, and I would highly recommend it to parents, to students, to anyone who wants to understand the course that the culture is taking, to understand some of our lawmakers and this bent toward Marxism. This is an excellent book to help us not only understand, but to be able to respond effectively. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Again, Mary Graybar, author of Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Georgine Rice Show. We're going to take a look at some of the things you need to know about the COVID-19 package that's on the verge of passing, with the Democrats. And we'll also look at the Dems' plan to forgive student loans, new ICE guidelines, and some other guidelines that are turning America into a sanctuary country. We'll look at that and more. And most importantly, I think, are Biden's orders on gender discrimination, the Equality Act, as it's being called. So all of that coming up here in the second hour. Well, Israel is cautioning the Biden administration against rejoining the Iran nuclear deal just one day. That was after the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said the U.S. was preparing to restart negotiations with an eye toward reviving an international commitment that the Trump administration abandoned 3 years ago. Israel believes that going back to the old nuclear agreement will pave Iran's path to a nuclear arsenal. This is a quote from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office in a statement. We remain committed to preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, he made the announcement during a video meeting with foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany, known as the E3, saying the U.S. will return to its commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as long as Iran does the same. Now, how meaningful that is and what Iran does is an open question. In other developments, Merrick Garland says that he does not support defunding the police. President Biden's attorney general nominee dodged questions from Senate Republicans, and Merrick Garland defended the Department of Justice nominee Kristen Clark, who called blacks superior. Merrick Garland is treading pretty carefully on the Durham probe and Hunter Biden at confirming hearing as well. Well, Biden has been grounded again after a United engine fire. The National Transportation Safety Board on Monday set a maintenance record, a group of them, after it failed the U.S. The United Airlines Flight 328 and erupted into flames shortly after takeoff on Saturday. Our mission is to be understand not only what happened, but why it happened, so we can keep it from happening again. That's the NTSB chairman, Robert Sumwalt, at a Monday evening press conference. Sumwalt emphasized that the investigation is still in its preliminary stages, asked whether the particular engine had been inspected after another engine failed on Southwest Airlines Flight 2018. Sumwalt said that that was a question that will be answered pending a maintenance group investigation. Well, Boeing has recommended that airlines ground all 777s with a type of engine that blew apart after takeoff from Denver this past weekend. And most carriers that fly those planes said they would temporarily pull them from service. Well, in other developments, the FAA has demanded an emergency inspection of select Boeing 777s after the midair explosion ripped the engine into pieces. And a United Airlines passenger has recalled a scary Boeing 777 engine explosion. No one wants to have that story to tell because survival is always questionable. Well, an ex-Clinton advisor, Naomi Wolf, has warned that the U.S. is becoming a totalitarian state before our eyes under Biden. Another New York dad-to-be has been killed in a gender reveal explosion. Just tell your people what you're having. You don't need to have some kind of pyrotechnic display. A Florida sheriff's deputy rescued a missing girl, 13, from a motel room with a man she met online. I hope you're talking to your kids. Saturday Night Live has a history of using Jews as the punchline. Alliance Defending Freedom says as they came on Lorne Michaels to take action. They're calling on him. A House committee is clearing $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. More on that later in the program. And citing storm damage in Texas, the IRS has delayed tax deadlines until June 15. Find out more at the Wall Street Journal. Jeff Bezos reportedly has linked to Washington football team as a new majority owner. And the U.S. can't compete with cheap U.S. solar panels. That will come back to bite us. Well, the Supreme Court turned down the Pennsylvania election dispute case. From the Wall Street Journal, what a missed opportunity to prevent future mischief. President Biden won by enough votes in enough states that this case wouldn't change the outcome, but it could have cut the odds of a meltdown next time. From another story, Justice Thomas wrote, a statement dissenting from the denial of the case filed by the Trump administration and the Pennsylvania GOP. Justice Alito wrote a separate statement in which he agreed with Justice Thomas, and Justice Gorsuch joined the Justice Alito statement. dissenting from the denial of review. Residents, Biden AG nominee, don't know if he'll prosecute illegal border crossings, among the many shocking things that came out of the Merrick Garland hearing. Garland also avoided the trans issue when asked a direct question. He responded, "The particular question on how Title IX applies in schools is something that I would have to look at when I have the chance to do that. I've not had the chance to consider these kinds of issues in my career so far." And Dr. Albert Mohler said there is a run-of-the-mill evasion, and that this is the kind of evasion that we don't need, no profit encourage, or rather no profile encourage here. Well, Biden Democrats are seeking to push the so-called Equality Act on unsuspecting Americans. Ryan Anderson points out that the act updates the law Congress passed primarily to combat racism, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but it adds sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes akin to race. So if you have any reservations about gender ideology, as even many progressives do, just ask J.K. Rowling. You now be the legal equivalent of Bull Connor. Dr. Albert Mohler says one of the other things that we need to note is that there are truly no meaningful religious liberty exemptions or protections in this legislation. Now, why is that way? Well, it's that way, first of all, because the Democrat majority that passed the bill in the last Congress doesn't see the need for those protections and actively opposed it. Franklin Graham says it has nothing to do with equality. It's just a smokescreen to force Americans to accept the LGBTQ agenda, and it creates a lot of inequality for Christians and all people of faith. It punishes individuals and organizations that disagree based on their moral convictions, and it is coming this way fast. Well, Apple has joined Amazon in removing the Ryan Anderson book we mentioned yesterday, as the book on trans is deemed politically incorrect. Molly Hemingway points out that our tech overlords are engaged in a type of digital book burning for thoughtful and important works produced by their most effective political opponents. It's horrible for it to be to happen anywhere, but appalling that this is happening in our country. Then comes this from Wall Street Journal editorial board. On Monday, two congressional Democrats wrote a stern letter to CEO Jeff Bezos about Amazon's role in politics. If you took seriously the party's promise to defend democratic norms, you might expect democratic politicians would express concern about the world's third largest company by market capitalization trying to suppress a book on a contested political issue. But the letter is a demand for more ideological censorship. Our country's public discourse is plagued by misinformation, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and lies, right? Representatives Anna Ishu and Jerry McNerney. They quote a claim that right-wing media is much more susceptible and demand to know why Amazon's Fire TV carries certain conservative programs. Silencing, marginalizing one particular point of view ends the debate, and certainly the Equality Act would impose a view and practice that is inconsistent with many conservative and Christian views. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. Well, a writer is being criticized for being a dad, a father. Many who took issue with Tim Carney's article on reopening schools use the fact that he is a father as a reason to be marginalized. I mean, what does he have to contribute to this conversation? Bethany Mandel says it says something about your personal life when you hold this view. You're a father, therefore you have no voice in this back and forth, this ongoing debate on reopening schools. Well, the chief of the Cherokee Nation is telling Jeep to stop selling Jeep Cherokees. Jeep has been selling them since 1974. Does anybody in this woke insanity expect Jeep to stand up to the Cherokee chief? It will be something different very, very soon. More people are searching Gina Carano on Google this is last week than Disney or Mandalorian. between the period of February 7th to the 13th, with Carano being fired on the 10th and announcing her partnership with the Daily Wire on the 12th, Google Trends indicated the interest in Gina Carano beat out The Mandalorian, with searches for Carano occurring more than three times as often as the Disney Plus show. Well, the same was true for Disney, with searches for Carano occurring almost 80% more often. WandaVision, the latest hit show on Disney Plus, lauded by many critics, was beaten by Carano by over 20% after Pedro Pascal, star of The Mandalorian, faced criticism for his past tweets comparing border control policies to the Holocaust. Carano was 10 times more popular online than terms of searches. Well, the new car smell, you know, that you get the new car and it has that kind of cool new car smell. Well, it can kill you, we're now being told. The story claims that what you're smelling are dangerous carcinogens created by the car's construction. Now people can justify wearing a mask in the car when they're alone. Well, the Supreme Court has refused to hear the GOP election case from Pennsylvania. At issue was a potentially important question for the 2024 election about whether state lawmakers or the state Supreme Court have the final word on a state's election rules. Lawyers for Pennsylvania Republicans urged the court to rule that the Constitution gave only state legislatures the final word on the election rules. They pointed to a provision in a 2019 law that said mail ballots must arrive by election day. Well, because of the pandemic, however, the Pennsylvania Secretary of State recommended changes in the deadline for counting mail-in ballots. One wonders what the courts are waiting for. We failed to settle this dispute before the election and thus provide clear rules. Now we can again fail to provide clear rules for future elections. The decision to leave the election, a law hidden beneath a shroud of doubt, is baffling. By doing nothing, we invite further confusion and erosion of voter confidence. This is a quote from Justice Clarence Thomas. Our fellow citizens deserve better and expect more from us. I respectfully dissent. Well, in other news, Dominion Voting Systems have filed a defamation suit against Mike Lindell of MyPillow. Well, despite repeated warnings and efforts to share the fact with him, Mr. Lindell, he has continued to maliciously spread false claims about Dominion, even each time having empty assurances that he would come forward with overwhelming proof. These claims have caused irreparable harm to Dominion's good reputation and threatened to the safety of our employees and customers. That's a quote from Dominion CEO John Paulus, and apparently a suit is pending. Well, President Biden's plan would effectively abolish ICE. It's being called preposterous. Well, during a remote meeting with agency personnel in Texas, several individuals familiar with the plan said Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas proposed converting some of the 4,000 ICE agents to criminal investigators, a move deportation officers compared to city police departments, transferring beat cops to detectives, effectively ending street patrols for basic crimes. And healthcare bore the brunt of the cyber attacks in 2020. Around the nation, California approved 600 stimulus payments for 5.7 million people. California lost 1.5 million jobs last year, mostly lower wages earners in the hospitality and restaurant industry. California has some of the most stringent coronavirus business rules in the country, banning indoor dining in much of the state, ordering retailers to limit the number of people allowed inside their stores. Well, San Francisco School Board, they've put holds on renaming its 44 schools. There were apparently other things going on. The San Francisco School Board has been criticized for its efforts to try to rename its 44 schools, where its names have ties to slavery, oppression, and gentrification. Many have criticized the board for not doing enough research, saying the committee that advised the school board got the facts wrong. And in the annals of social justice, the caliphate, chief of the Cherokee Nation, as I mentioned, is asking that Jeep change the name of its Cherokee. We'll see what happens there. I'm guessing it will change the name. Seattle-backed homeless shelters are providing a heroin how-to guide and paraphernalia. I'm sure that will help. A university professor has been fired for a class illustration deemed transphobic, and the U.S. COVID death toll has passed 500,000. However, daily COVID deaths have fallen to 1,200, the lowest since before the holiday season. Canada laudably joined the U.S. by declaring China's treatment of Uyghurs genocide. The mother of the Capitol officer, Brian Sicknick, believes he died of a stroke, and the narrative that was painted during the impeachment hearing, not true. States set for a clash with the Biden administration over transgender athletes, and Illinois has become the first state to fecklessly eliminate cash bail. Kelly Loeffler starts the Georgia voter guide to revive Stacey Abrams, or rather to rival Stacey Abrams. And we're shocked the wife of El Chapo apparently was arrested in the U.S. on drug charges. Well, on this day in history, 1998, the Titanic ties an Academy Awards record by winning 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, and Song. If I never hear it again, life will go on. 1775, Patrick Henry delivers an address to the Virginia Provincial Convention, in which observers say he declares, "Give me liberty or give me death." 1806, explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, having reached the Pacific coast, begin their journey back. 1933, the German Reichstag adopts the Enabling Act, which effectively grants Adolf Hitler dictatorial powers. 1941, the first Japanese-American evacuated by the U.S. Army during World War II arrives at the internment camp in Mananzer, California. 1956, Pakistan becomes an Islamic republic. 1965, on this day in history, America's first two-person space mission takes place in Gemini 3 as it blasts off with astronaut Virgil Gus Grissom and John Young. They were aboard for nearly five-hour flight. 1983, President Ronald Reagan first proposes developing technology to intercept incoming enemy missiles, an ideal that came to be known as the Strategic Defense Initiative. 1983, Dr. Barney Clark, recipient of the Jarvik Permanent Artificial Heart, dies at the University of Utah Medical Center after 112 days with the device. 2012, Adolf Suarez, Spain's first democratically elected prime minister, after decades of right-wing rule under General Francisco Franco, dies in Madrid at age 81. And finally, 2018, President Trump issues an order banning most transgender troops from serving in the military, except under limited circumstances. Well, there's a lot going on when we come back from our break here in just a moment. I want to talk about some of the things you need to know about the deeply flawed COVID-19 package. So we'll get into that in just a few moments. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. Well, as you know, the Democrats are moving closer to passing their COVID-19 package. It's got a lot in it, and not much of it relates specifically to COVID-19. But later this week, we know the House of Representatives is expected to consider a massive legislative package. It's being sold as another relief measure for the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, sadly, the legislation is stuffed with provisions that have nothing to do with the disease or economic hardship, and in some cases would actually allow the economy to slow in its rebound and destroy jobs. Well, here's some of the facts that you need to know, because, again, this is coming up in the House this week, and we're likely to see some kind of vote on it by the end of the week. Well, it adds over $14,000 per household to the national debt. Now, that's kind of personal. The pandemic, coupled with its effects on the economy, led to an unprecedented amount of federal spending. In fiscal 2020, it was over $50,000 per household. This year, we can already expect another $45,000 per household. Now, despite the fact that the unemployment rate is 6.3%, which is not ideal, it's not a crisis. And despite the fact that COVID-19 hospitalizations are plunging, Democrats in Congress and the Biden administration, they're pushing for a package that would send spending well above last year's records. Well, the total national debt has risen to $27.9 trillion, or more than $215,000 per household, adding trillions more to that debt, add risks for the future. So we may think, oh, everything's fine now, but look ahead. The total national debt has risen, as I mentioned, 27.9 trillion. Adding trillions more to the debt adds risk for the future. Now, since we're unlikely to see a balanced budget anytime soon, every penny of that debt on the books today will need to be refinanced. And even though interest rates are now low, we have no way of knowing what credit markets will demand in the years to come. Just as a responsible middle-class household would carefully consider whether to add $14,000 debt, Congress, they have to be cautious rather than reckless with the nation's finances. And this piece of legislation, quite frankly, doesn't do that. It is a COVID-19 bill that treats COVID-19 as something of an afterthought. And while combating the pandemic ought to be the centerpiece of the legislation referred to as the COVID-19 relief, public health represents less than 10% of the spending in this package. So again, putting it into perspective, it's something more akin to an afterthought. The legislation throws massive amounts of taxpayer dollars at causes that are barely or entirely unrelated to the pandemic, yet neglects some potentially crucial approaches to bringing the disease under control. One example, rapid tests. For COVID-19, it could be developed for a fraction of the cost of the package. It would yet provide a vital tool for individuals and the medical community in preventing unnecessary disease transmission. Sadly, however, the Food and Drug Administration is dragging its feet, having only approved one type of rapid test that will be available in limited quantities later in the year. Operation Warp Speed helped to ensure that the multiple vaccines were available, meaning multiple manufacturers making as many doses as possible. A similar approach is needed for rapid tests, and leaders should prioritize this public health need above favors for political allies, but you're not going to see it in this COVID legislation. It's also massive education spending that won't actually reopen schools. The package spends $170 billion on education, which supporters say is meant to reopen schools faster. Sadly, again, the details show something else entirely. First, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office revealed that only about a third of the educational funds would be spent between now and September 2022, and that more would be spent in 2026 than in 2021. Now, that's utterly absurd given the urgency of getting kids back in the classroom. Second, about $50 billion in funds for reopening the schools have yet to go out at all, most of which was just passed in December. Now, considering that youths are at the lowest risk of the disease and that teachers are receiving preferential treatment on vaccinations, $50 billion should be more than enough. In reality, the additional $170 billion is a de facto payoff to teachers' unions, many of which are currently issuing demands for reopening schools. Well, unreasonable demands. Providing the extra funding would reward this counterproductive behavior and should be vehemently opposed. It's sad that it's in the COVID-19 legislation. Also, it opens, and we're talking about this COVID-19 legislation, it opens the door for taxpayer-funded abortions. Now, what does that have to do with COVID-19 in the present? Well, this means family planning money for Planned Parenthood, subsidies for health plans that cover abortions, and even international funds without pro-life protections. It should be unconscionable that legislation supposedly justified as a way to preserve human life would do the opposite, but this is where we are in this legislation. Well, its unprecedented minimum wage increase would kill jobs and businesses. That's in the legislation. And while lawmakers should pass pro-investment and pro-jobs legislation during a recession, Congress is doing the opposite, attempting to staple a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour onto a package that is supposedly about the pandemic, but largely is not. The legislation includes opportunistic welfare expansion that create perverse incentives. It includes benefits, increases, and expansions for a variety of safety net programs that includes unemployment insurance, Affordable Care Act subsidies, and earned income tax credits, cash welfare payments, and more. All of this ignores the fact that the federal and state government already provide an expansive safety net for unemployed and low-wage workers at a tremendous cost to taxpayers. The economy is struggling, but it's a much better shape than it was during the Great Recession. So there is no meaningful justification for expanding the welfare state. Worse, expanding the benefits will reduce incentives to find work, marry, or increase earnings, each of which can reduce what the federal government provides to an individual. Another danger is that these welfare expansions could become permanent, and most likely will, which would harm the nation's finances and cement anti-work incentives in place. The COVID legislation would give huge handouts to special interests. The bill includes more than $1,000 per person in funds for state and local governments, despite the fact that federal aid last year dwarfed any localized revenue reductions. At least $90 billion will be given from the general public to pad out pension plans for private sector workers, overwhelmingly benefiting big labor. The plan is a bailout. It could balloon to more than twice the amount granted. On top of that, $57 billion will go toward the transportation sector in a way that privileges unionized workers. Well, these three items alone amount to $500 billion that will create far more in political benefits than public benefits. Its $1,400 check would have minimal economic effect, maximum debt impact, and that's the biggest item in the bill, $1,400 per person recovery debate checks. It's expected to cost over $400 billion. We have plenty of evidence to know that this would be a poor way to stimulate the economy. First, the vast majority of working age Americans are employed, and those who are out of work are eligible for boosted unemployment benefits. There's no inherent economic need for nearly universal checks. I mean, it sounds good. We all can visualize how we would spend it. But second, Americans increased savings and debt repayment in the wake of last year's federal checks. And while this was the responsible thing for many Americans to do, it's an irresponsible policy choice at a time of high deficits. Third, analysis from previous stimulus checks shows that they provide only a small short-term boost to the economy and jobs. And since they add to our mountainous national debt, they'll ultimately slow the economy in the long run, and we'll all suffer the consequence. Well, lawmakers responding to the COVID-19 pandemic should work together to enact temporary and targeted measures that will help bring this disease under control and allow the economy to continue to improve. However, this $1.9 trillion package represents a jarring leftward lurch to enact longstanding progressive policies that have nothing to do with a pandemic, and it's riddled with poor economic reasoning, political favoritism that would needlessly add to the national debt. So lawmakers should go back to the drawing board rather than rush to pass this bloated bill. However, they are rushing to pass this bloated bill. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. Well, the so-called Equality Act was introduced in Congress this week and is likely to soon be heard on the House floor. Emilio Cao, who writes for the Heritage Foundation, he's the director of the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society, released a statement in response to what will be a major battle in the days and weeks to come. He writes that every American should be treated with dignity and respect, and no one should face unjust discrimination. I think we all agree on that. But the Equality Act creates inequality and discrimination by stigmatizing and penalizing the beliefs that hundreds of millions of Americans hold about biological sex and marriage. It forces them to confront a government-mandated belief on gender and sex that violate their conscience by threatening them with financial and criminal penalties. This bill brings us one step closer to a dystopian nightmare where Americans of all faiths and no faith will be forced to agree with government-imposed ideology or be treated as an outlaw. At the same time, this legislation erases the gains and protections for girls and women in our nation. No law should eliminate privacy and safety in intimate spaces or demolish fair competitions in the name of political correctness. Even more troubling is the far-ranging impact this bill will have on Americans' way of life. This will upend our constitutional freedoms, instill destructive gender ideologies in schools, politicize medicine, open the door to taxpayer-funded abortions, and decimate parental rights. Make sure that Americans do not face unjust discrimination simply for identifying as gay or transgender does not mean changing our nation's civil rights laws so that political viewpoints about sex and a destructive gender ideology become state orthodoxy through punishment and dissenters. And this is what the Family Research Council said in response to the White House giving support to H.R. 5, deceptively titled the Equality Act, which was introduced in the House of Representatives, scheduled for a vote next week. Tony Perkins says this: to wrest special privileges for sexual orientation and gender identity, the so-called Equality Act would eliminate women's privacy and safety, forcing them to share public bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, and even battered women's shelters with biological males. The harms aren't hypothetical. Laws to this effect have already been led to a kindergartner being assaulted in her school restroom, a rape survivor being forced to quit her job, and 9 women being harassed in a shelter. The bill erodes parental rights and positions the government as lord over churches and other faith-based institutions, potentially dictating how their facilities are used, who they hire, and even punishing them for not falling in step with a view of human sexuality that directly contradicts orthodox biblical teaching, not to mention science. No person of faith or religious institutions, whether schools, churches, synagogues, mosques, businesses, or nonprofits, will escape the Orwellian reach of the Equality Act. When Speaker Pelosi says she isn't concerned about the collateral damage of her agenda, she means it. The bill would bring a catastrophic loss of religious freedom in America. And as a result, every American, those who believe and do not believe, will suffer the consequence of this change. Well, this is what is coming. And while our time is short, I didn't have sufficient time to cover it in greater detail. I do want to say this and promise to return at some point in the very near future, since this is moving through the system. The Equality Act undermines hard-fought gains for women. It imposes on women's privacy, unfairly penalizes female athletes by allowing biological males to compete in women's sports. It flagrantly denies the scientific evidence of real biological differences. This bill also politicizes the medical profession and denies biological reality. It's harming those in claims to protect. It could also be the most pro-abortion legislation to pass the House in a decade, dramatically expanding abortion access and jeopardizing longstanding federal conscience laws. All Americans should strongly speak out against this. It's actually the Inequality Act rather than the Equality Act. So keep that in mind, and we will spend some time explaining precisely what it proposes to do and follow it as it makes its way, beginning in the U.S. House. One other news: on February 23rd, 1945, 6 Marines with the 5th Division raised the American flag atop Mount Suribachi during the Battle of Iwo Jima. 3 of them, Sergeant Michael Strank, Corporal Harlan Block, and Private First Class Franklin Sousley, were killed in action before the battle was over. Joe Rosenthal's iconic image was the inspiration for the Marine Corps War Memorial outside of the Ward Weitzel Gate to Arlington Cemetery, National Cemetery. That flag can now be seen in the National Museum of the Marine Corps near MCB Quantico. The major conflict against 20th century tyrants cost 616,124 American lives. Some of them were your fathers, your uncles, your sons, your daughters, your brothers. 616,124 American lives. And 1,120,283 wounded in a bloody theater of warfare, one battle at a time. Now, too many have no idea what's been sacrificed for their liberty, for the freedom many arrogantly squander today. Ignorance is bliss until it's not. Winston Churchill once said, "Never was so much owed by so many to so few." And as we remember the Battle of Iwo Jima, we are reminded that that is certainly the case right here in the United States. We face many challenges here at home as our disagreements have flared up into violent incidents. But the fact that we can engage in either productive or non-productive debate, we can debate legislation, we can consider others' ideas, and so on, rests on the fact that there were those who were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice, many who made that sacrifice by being wounded physically and otherwise, but giving us the freedom, the liberty that we currently enjoy to engage in these disputes, to bend the knee, to take the knee, if you will, and pray about the future of our republic. And many were willing to sacrifice in order for us to have the freedom and liberty to do just that. So we remember that one incident because it is linked to so many others and has purchased for us so much of the freedom we enjoy. We thank you. Well, we're just about out of time. I do want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering, and Dan Rice for the use of his office. I also want to thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.